Support for this podcast and the following message come from Dell Technologies. What can a pizza chain teach you about pivoting? Where does Bitcoin's true value lie? And does your inbox need AI? Search for Trailblazers in your favorite podcast app to hear all those stories and more.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Alyssa Block, and this is On Point. Seismologist Lucy Jones has long been trying to warn us that the big one is inevitable. Could be a hurricane, an earthquake, volcanic eruption, tsunami, catastrophic flood, and it's not like we haven't seen it before.
1980, Mount St. Helens erupts.
Enormous waves rolling across the Indian Ocean.
We're getting ripped here with the backside, if you will, of Katrina.
Major earthquake of magnitude 7.9 hitting Japan.
There is a 100% chance that a major natural disaster will hit us again someday, maybe soon, maybe not. And it's this unpredictability that we humans have a hard time with. We don't do well with randomness. In her new book titled The Big Ones, Lucy Jones reminds us of past catastrophes and urges us to act. This hour on Point, getting ready for the big one. You can join us on air or online. What natural disasters keep you up at night, if at all? What have you done to prepare? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We'd love to hear from you. And Lucy Jones is with us now from Pasadena, California. She is a world-renowned seismologist. She recently retired after more than 30 years at the U.S. Geological Survey. She's also a research associate at Caltech and the founder of the Dr. Lucy Jones Center for Science and Society. Her new book is titled The Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Lucy Jones, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And I think a lot of us, when we hear that phrase, the big one, we immediately think about a massive earthquake striking the West Coast.
It's been the one probably most often talked about. My whole career here in Southern California, it's probably the most common question that I've had. What's the big one? When's the big one? The term has entered our common culture.
And people want to know when that will be. If it's coming, please tell us when that will happen, which is something that you cannot do. An earthquake cannot be predicted.
Right. We can't tell you when. The thing is, we can tell you what. No, and I used to answer the question very scientifically. Oh, yes, a magnitude 7.8 or greater earthquake on the San Andreas Fault. And I, you know, part of writing the book and is an evolution of my thoughts and realizing that the big one is really a cultural term rather than a scientific term. Mm. And that it's about fundamentally changing the nature of our society.
I'm interested in the book when you talk about the plate tectonics at work here, that they are pushing Los Angeles toward San Francisco, you write, at the same rate your fingernails grow, which is such a fascinating metaphor to think about. I never really thought about what that rate would be.
Right. And it doesn't. That seems very slow, doesn't it? And yet imagine if you didn't cut your fingernails for 200 years. It's a pretty big emotion that we're that's left to be accommodated in one earthquake.
And this says, what, 2 inches a year? That's the rate? 2 inches a year that LA is?
Just under 2 inches a year. And, so in 5 million years, LA will be a suburb of San Francisco or perhaps vice versa.
If we stick around to wait for that to happen. You did something called Shakeout, which was a modeling at the U.S. Geological Survey of what a big one would look like. What did you find? What was that scenario?
Okay, so yeah, almost 10 years ago, we started this process, and what is a big San Andreas earthquake going to do to Southern California? And it's physically incredibly daunting. It's 1,800 dead, 53,000 injured, 300,000 buildings that are severely damaged, 250,000 people who've lost their homes. Some areas won't have water for up to 6 months. So it's physically we can describe it as a imperiling the basic structures of society.
And as you point out in the book, you got to play God a little bit. You got to choose the weather in this scenario. You happened to choose a cool, calm day, which would be optimal weather-wise. If the weather were hot, dry, windy, things would be much, much worse.
Well, yeah, this modeling and every big, really big earthquake that we've seen in a a major city, has led to catastrophic fires. And, you know, by this, I've got to remind you that Northridge was not a big earthquake. There were 110 fires that got started, but that was small enough that we had the resources to fight them. When you get to the much longer fault and the bigger earthquakes, there will be so many fires, our estimate for shakeout is 1,600. Mm. We just don't have enough fire companies to fight it. And so even with a cool, calm day, we still had fires that doubled the losses. And that's why we said, we're not going to have Santa Ana winds, because if we did that, it is just a fire scenario. And I'm not sure we can fight those fires.
That's
sort of my sort of personal nightmare, is the big earthquake during a Santa Ana wind condition.
That's a terrifying scenario. I'd love to have you read a part of your book where you are talking about how we are really fundamentally unable to register randomness of these events and where we might want to shift blame when things do go wrong in a random way. And you're playing out a scenario for what might happen when the big one does strike Southern California. Could you read that part for us?
Sure, right. So this is about the shakeout. When that great Southern California earthquake finally strikes, I know two things will happen. First, rumors will spread that the scientists know that another earthquake is coming, but that we aren't saying anything to avoid scaring the public. This is the all-too-human rejection of the random, an attempt to form patterns to find reassurance. Second, there will be blame. Some will blame FEMA, accusing them of a poor response. Some will blame the government for allowing bad buildings to have been constructed, maybe even the same people who fought against mandatory improvements of those weak buildings. Some will blame scientists for not listening to that week's earthquake predictor. Some, in a pattern we have seen for centuries, will blame the sinners of the hedonistic la-la land. The last thing any of us will want to do is accept that sometimes shift just happens.
Lucy Jones, I think I laughed out loud when I came to that last line. You're talking about shift, S-H-I-F-T, tectonic shift in the plates, which is just, it's hard for us to wrap our brains around that. The Earth as we know it is moving at some rate, and that things, when those plates shift in bad ways and fault lines emerge, that awful, awful things can happen.
Well, I think one of the things I have come to understand and tried to put into the book is how the geologic perspective changes the way you think about this. You know, that I can talk about the last 10,000 years as recent without any sense of irony. That to a geologist, that is very recent. And that on geologic time, we know exactly what we have to deal with, you know, how many earthquakes we're going to have every million years. The problem, of course, is that on human time scales, it becomes just random. It's sort of like, you know, you have a Geiger counter, you know how many clicks are going to happen each minute, but whether or not it will be in this millisecond, completely random. And the problem is our lifetimes are that random part for geologic phenomenon. And as a geologist, you see this and you see it and you see it as part of the world. And then you come into human time frames and discover that people think, well, maybe it just won't happen. And it makes me want to shake them. And instead, I wrote a book.
That's your version of shaking, physical shaking. Why do you think that is? Why do we have such a hard time with randomness? You write that we want to find meaning. We want to find patterns, that the awesome power of the natural world, we want to sort of ascribe things to it, whether it might be omens or the yin-yang balance of the world being out of whack, or sin, that hedonistic la-la land that you write about. We're looking for explanations that just don't exist.
We want explanations, and it's a pretty deep instinctual need. I mean, think about human beings, how we came to be who we are. We're evolving out of the other primates in the savanna. We don't have as big muscles as others. We don't have such strong teeth, but we have our brains. And when we're faced with danger, we would make patterns. We'd use these brains to find the pattern where we could be safe. And it was fundamental to our survival and evolution. So it's deeply wired into us when faced with danger to make a pattern. And it has served us extremely well in letting us figure out how to, you know, avoid bad mushrooms or, you know, all the different patterns that we create. The problem, of course, is that when it's fundamentally random, that need doesn't turn off and we make the patterns anyway. And, you know, this looking back over time, in early human cultures, without as such understanding of the physical processes, faced with this on human time frame random distribution, the one place we could put the form the pattern that wasn't disproved was to put it on the gods. So you go back to the pagan cultures and, you know, Vesuvius erupts when Venus cheats on Vulcan and he's having a male hissy fit. And it's just you get in the way of those capricious, dangerous, strong, but self-centered beings. And then the Judeo-Christian tradition rejected that, saying, no, God's good. God's somebody you can make a covenant with. So if he hit you with a disaster, it must be your fault. But because we had to find a place to we don't know how to face danger and just say, shift happens, whatever. It's such a deep human need. I don't imagine we will ever stop doing that. And the challenge, and it's, you know, sort of a challenge of science too, find the pattern, use statistics to make sure it's real, and when it's random, okay, use the, you know, the statistics to help you understand that and figure out how to move on.
And thinking about that point, you note in the book that the etymology of the word disaster has everything to do with what you're talking about, this randomness or the notion that things are fateful.
Yeah, the word actually first shows up in the 16th century. One of very early uses is Shakespeare. And, you know, the fault, dear Brutus, is not in our in stars, but in ourselves. That's because they really believed it was in the stars. Disaster means ill-starred.
That's our little vocabulary etymology lesson for the day. I'm going to hang on to that one. We're talking about natural disasters with seismologist Lucy Jones, and you can join the conversation. What natural disasters give you cause for concern, make you wake up in a cold sweat? What do you make of Lucy Jones' call to action to be prepared? I'm Melissa Block, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Dell Technologies. Can technology reduce healthcare costs? What will it take to personalize the education of every student? And where does the media go from here? Find these answers and more on Trailblazers, a podcast hosted by best-selling author Walter Isaacson and joined by extraordinary guests who share their stories, insights, and the lessons they learned while transforming entire industries. Stream Trailblazers in your favorite podcast app, or at DellTechnologies.com/trailblazers.
Hi, I'm Mindy Thomas from NPR's Wow in the World. And this week, it's all about Operation Earth, how to be cool to a planet that's getting hot. Check it out with the curious and conscientious kids in your life. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Melissa Block. We're talking with seismologist Lucy Jones about natural disasters, and you can join the conversation. What's your question for Lucy Jones? How can we do more to prepare for the inevitable? Maybe you think we're already doing enough. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest is Lucy Jones, internationally renowned seismologist. She's the author of the new book, The Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them. You mentioned earlier, Dr. Jones, that what we think about with the big earthquakes in California, in particular the Northridge earthquake from 1994, which struck the San Fernando Valley, that wasn't too bad. And I want to just play a little bit of tape here. This is Tom Brokaw, who at the time was reporting for NBC Nightly News.
This area is still trying to recover tonight from a major earthquake that struck early this morning in the San Fernando Valley in Northridge, which is about 10 miles northwest of where I'm standing. And it did major damage throughout the Los Angeles basin. It was 6.6 on the Richter scale. 5 major highways have been cut. Water supplies threatened. Gas mains have exploded. A half dozen communities have exploded in flames. And the death toll has been going up all day long.
Dr. Jones, in the end, what was the death toll from that earthquake? I don't recall.
It actually is only 35 people.
Only?
The direct deaths. There were another 20 or 30 heart attacks during the earthquake. I don't usually try to attribute those to the earthquake, given there's 140 heart attacks in L.A. every day.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot of people, though. I mean, not compared to the big one, but that's still 30 people. That's
well, the same. It is and it isn't. The same week, more people than that died in an ice storm on the East Coast.
Hmm.
So because we have been so obsessed about life safety and the, you know, the fear of dying and the fear of the randomness, we've done a lot about making our buildings not kill us. So we have what's called a life safety building standard, making sure that the building won't kill you in the earthquake. We don't care if the building's destroyed. And so we actually have built in trillions of dollars of losses. And what we have is a situation where 35 people died, but $40 billion in financial losses.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I say that's not the big one is because the damage was pretty concentrated to the area above the fault. It usually is. But that fault was only 10 miles across. So the San Fernando Valley, especially the western part of the San Fernando Valley, was the overwhelming majority of the losses. When we have the big one on the San Andreas, the fault's going to be 200 miles long.
Wow.
And instead of 500,000 people getting the worst shaking, we're going to have like 10 million people getting really bad shaking.
The tape we just heard from Tom Brokaw mentions a half dozen communities exploding into flames, and I keep coming back to this notion of just whole cities, whole regions on fire. We did have a commenter earlier asking whether there is a military response that is planned for that scenario if the fire companies where the earthquake happens are destroyed or unable to get to the scene. What is the planning about that?
Well, that's actually one of the good things that I've seen happening, the sort of the ability to grasp our more distant disasters that's been happening over the last decade or so. And FEMA has extensive plans. They used the shakeout that we created, so it's the best science model. That's been the basis for the catastrophic planning for Southern California, and it involves mobilizing large amounts of resources. The challenge is going to be that the earthquake will also disrupt our transportation. And so every road that crosses the San Andreas Fault is going to now have a 20 or 30 foot offset in it. And much of those other resources are going to have to come in from outside the region and therefore across the fault. And within the region, even without the fault, you have no stoplights, you have debris in the road. It's going to be very hard to move around.
Let's go to the phones. We have a call from Jonathan in Charlotte, North Carolina. Jonathan, welcome.
Hey, Melissa. I just wanted to point out, we've been talking about physical damage to the cities and an actual event happening where you live. But I was wondering if we could talk about supply chains and how you walk through the grocery store, you see where a lot of your produce comes from, how a natural or man-made disaster very far away from where we are can have a huge impact because of the way we centralize populations and food production.
Lucy Jones, what about that ripple effect?
That is a really great point. You know, we were just talking about Northridge. When it happened, our grocery store chains had big warehouses in what's called the Inland Empire area of Southern California, from which they would, you know, send food out to their different stores. So we had a big local supply of food. That has changed with the internet. You know, we now have the just-in-time economy, and we don't have warehouses anymore. It means our food distribution is much more efficient, and our food is cheaper because of that, but we don't have local supplies of food in general. And the disruption that's going to happen anywhere that disrupts the supply chains, and that overall is a big issue. Beyond supply chains, water and electricity, gas and sewer are all major infrastructure systems that are necessary to support life in our, you know, now dense urban environments. When the 1906 earthquake hit San Francisco, the sewers are broken. Well, you build an outhouse in your backyard. If we now break the sewers in Southern California or any other major city, we have a potential public health nightmare. So the increased complexity of our cities is increasing our vulnerability. And as the caller said, it's also not just your own city because of supply chains. You know, the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach bring in over 40% of the imports to the United States, and they get to the rest of the country on two main railway lines, both of which cross the San Andreas Fault and both of which will be broken in this earthquake. So, you know, our globalization means we have a more connected society and the impacts in one area are going to be felt over a larger area than they used to be.
We've been focusing, Dr. Jones, on earthquakes, but I want to steer you back in time to the 18th century and what's described as the greatest global catastrophe ever. This was the volcanic eruption in Iceland at Laki. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, the Laki craters.
And deadliest in human history. Explain what happened.
Okay, yeah, you'd wonder how can a, you know, Iceland only had 50,000 people in at the time of that volcanic eruption. Almost a quarter of them died because of that eruption. Not the lava itself. It moved slowly enough they could get out of the way, but there were extremely large quantities of poisonous gases that came out with the lava. And they were two of them, fluorine and sulfur, basically sulfur compounds. And the because they were there was an explosive phases or multiple explosive phases, those gases got shot up into the atmosphere and made it up into the stratosphere. They also settled out over Iceland, and a large part of the death became people poisoned by the fluorine gases that destroyed all of the land-based food. But then the gases also in the regular atmosphere blew over to Europe. And they estimate 23,000 people died that summer in the United Kingdom by comparing death tolls of that summer versus others, which was just this poisonous gases sitting in the fields. And people would go out to work in the fields and end up collapsing. And it moved on into Europe and killed a lot of people there as well. And then the part that got into the stratosphere cooled the earth so that winter was one of the coldest ever in Europe. It ended up leading to a famine that has been that definitely contributed to the unrest that led to the French Revolution. But then the further cooling that happened, that once the gases were in the stratosphere, traveled around the world, cooled the continents, which disrupted the monsoons. So the Nile did not flood, and there was a famine in Egypt that killed about 600,000 people. And then there were droughts and famines in both India and Japan. There were almost 12 million people that died from those famines. Now, there was a complication of an El Nino probably at the same time, so it's not all on the eruption. But it's clear that we're talking about millions of people that ended up dying. And when you look at that sort of thing, I mean, volcanoes are unique among the catastrophes that they can have a direct physical impact on the whole world and not just a supply chain issue.
And that's what's so terrifying about it, right? That this spread so far, and all from tiny Iceland, which you mentioned had such a benign name for these poisonous gases. They call them the mist hardships, M-I-S-T, mist hardships.
Yeah, well, for them, I mean, the Scandinavian bent for understatement.
Step
hardships,
up with it. Yeah,
right. I mean, the whole country, and to me, I saw that event as the archetype of a catastrophe. You know, it's a disaster to yourself when the lava runs through your house and burns it down and covers your fields, but this is an event where the whole country became a nation of refugees. They wiped out basically the whole farmland of the country. And there's the records of births and deaths disappear through that time because there was like no one left it to record who died in many communities. And you know, the most inhabited part of the country, they had to pick up and leave to move to other parts. And that's the thing, the idea that when your society itself is imperiled. What's impressive to me is that Iceland did recover from that. It would have been very easy for them, the remaining few people, to, you know, sail off to Denmark or something. But they stayed and they fought. And there are great stories of individuals who supported their communities and pulled them together. And I found that inspiring.
Let's go back to the phones. We have a call from the center of the country, from Omaha, Nebraska. And Jim, you're on the line.
Hi, Melissa.
Hey.
Yeah, I do live in the center of the country, and I'm wondering, am I more protected from the big ones, or am I susceptible to the randomness and unpredictability just like anyone else?
Am I safe? Jim is asking, Dr. Jones.
Right. We all want to know, are we safe? Well, and it depends upon which disaster. You are less likely to get hit by earthquakes. It's possible, but much rarer. Of course, we have been able to start creating earthquakes in Oklahoma with the pumping of fluids deep into the earth. So we are seeing more earthquakes there right now, but that's the number's been coming down as they've been putting more restrictions on how the pumping can happen. But you have other disasters, right? You have tornadoes and you have floods. And that's one of the other things I want to say to people is figure out what your disaster is. I think the most important thing you can do is educate yourself. So what matters in your community? The earthquakes are frightening, but overall, floods kill more Americans and do more damage. And you definitely got floods available to you in that part of the country. And then the meteorologic disasters are increasing with the increased heat in our atmosphere. And so the intensity and pervasiveness of tornadoes is increasing, for instance. And that's, of course, another big issue.
Let's go back to the phones and to Bowling Green, Kentucky. Listener Aaron, you're on the line.
Hi, Melissa. How y'all doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm all right. I do have go bags for each member of my family. We have a 3-day supply of food. We've got portable tents, waterproof matches, water supplies to go with there. But I'm kind of concerned about tornadoes and fires if they happen. Is there something else we could do that would help us to be more prepared?
A practical question there from Kentucky. Dr. Jones, what would you tell Aaron?
Okay, a very practical thing. I didn't quite hear whether you said this, but one of the most important things is really effective planning with your family, because when communications go out, we've become very dependent on our cell phones. And so just thinking it through ahead of time and really talking about it with all members of the family, you know, of course, one thing I always did was when my children became old enough to be home alone, I taught them how to turn off the gas, because that's a big issue for earthquakes, but also, you know, talked through the plans. Who do you talk to? Who do you go to for help? The other part that I would strongly recommend is to do this with your neighbors. You know, when we look at what happens with these really big events, it's not about individuals dying in general. Even in the, you know, eruption in Pompeii, 90% of the victims got out. It's about the community surviving. And people stay in a place where they have connections. And the more we can do with our communities to get ready for disasters, the more likely those organizations will be there to help us afterwards and help keep people there. So I would, you know, say, have you talked with your church or your school or wherever you connect to other people? What can you do together? And then the other thing is, in most of these disasters, much of the damage is preventable, but probably not by an individual. It's something that happens at a local government level. It's why we have various zoning regulations. So are you building too many houses underneath the levees? Well, if you want that changed, you've got to talk with your local government officials. So letting your elected officials, your local elected officials, know that this matters to you is a really important part of making our communities more resilient.
That's interesting. So you're talking about the micro level of just what you can do to prepare yourself with, as the caller mentioned, a go bag, but also looking more broadly at the community and how to make the community itself more sound.
Our messaging. Okay.
Let's take another call here. This is Eric calling from San Francisco. Eric, what's on your mind?
Hey, Melissa.
Hey.
Just wanted to let you know that it was very timely. I finished the neighborhood emergency response training that we have in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. It's offered by the fire department. And you learn everything from what supplies you need around the house to helping you and your family first, to shutting off gas and water, electricity the right way, to making sure your neighbors are okay, and then receiving certification at the end to assist the fire department in the event of a natural disaster. I know that in regard to earthquakes, we've been lucky. My wife and I bought our house in 1994. We haven't had a damaging quake since, but we just bought earthquake insurance this year.
Uh-huh.
And as time goes on, I feel sometimes that we're living on borrowed time here.
Thanks for your call, Eric. I imagine, Dr. Jones, that taking a class like this could build confidence, could actually supply some useful skills.
This is a very important piece. It provides skills and it provides connections with your neighbors. The one thing I'd say is, and not surprising when it's something coming from the fire department, it's very focused on response. And that's back to this, our human fear of randomness keeps us very focused on the moment of the disaster. And we are much more willing to do things to prepare to respond, to fund our firemen, than we are to prevent the losses. So at the same time that San Francisco does a great program like this, they're still building buildings that are going to be a total financial loss in the earthquake.
All right, we're going to pick up that conversation after the break. We are discussing natural disasters and how best to prepare for those in the future. You can join the conversation. What have you done to prepare and what's happening in your community? I'm Melissa Block, and you're listening to On Point.
Are you funnier than Fallon? More amusing than Aziz? More clever than Click and Clack? Well, if you've got an idea that'll make people laugh, enter WBUR's Next Great Show contest for a chance to get your show on the air. To find out more, go to WBUR.org/nextgreatshow.
This is On Point. I'm Melissa Block. We're joined today by Lucy Jones. She's a seismologist and associate researcher at Caltech, the author of the book The Big Ones. And joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Lauren Alexander Augustine. She is director of the Program on Risk, Resilience, and Extreme Events at the National Academy of Sciences. Her team has been working to build resilience in four U.S. communities, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, Charleston, South Carolina, Seattle, and Tulsa, Oklahoma. Lauren, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. And I wonder if you could give us some examples of the kind of work when you're talking about building resilience in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. What does that mean? What form does that take?
Well, I'll tell you that in all of our four communities, we thought everyone wanted to talk about disasters, but really people in communities want to talk about vulnerable populations and economic resilience. So in Cedar Rapids, for example, they had a huge flood in 2008. No one died, but there was a lot of damage, and they took a lot of lessons from that. And one of the things that they wanted our help in working with them with is to figure out how do you take this risk of floods and disaster and risk and integrate the preparedness across all the different aspects of community work. So public health, school districts, emergency management, first responders, long-term planning, land use, those kinds of things. And how do we make sure, how do they make sure that their decisions are evidence-based and generated and guided by some of the leading science and best information available.
So that's Cedar Rapids, Iowa. What about Tulsa? Your work in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yeah, so Tulsa is a really interesting case because when we started there, we thought that tornadoes or droughts and kind of the meteorological events would be driving the discussion. But they said, listen, we can't really talk about that yet because our city budget is really uncertain from year to year. And so we ended up working in Tulsa on sales tax revenue and using that as an indicator for economic resilience that related, as it turns out, to some of their direct plans for land use planning. When you started to overlay where their revenue was coming from to some of the historic paths of tornadoes, they started to rethink the distribution of places where their sales tax revenue could be generated, and that is where and how their city budget is actually generated. So in Tulsa, it was a very different story, but again, using scientific information and analysis for sound decision-making.
Let's bring Lucy Jones back in and also go to a call. We have Brian on the line from Madison, Wisconsin, with a call that I think relates to this question about Oklahoma. Brian, go ahead.
Yes, ma'am. Thanks for the call.
Of course.
I was just curious about all the fracking that's going on in Oklahoma, North Dakota. I know when they were fracking before, they're saying there was little quakes in Oklahoma, a lot more than they usually get. That's pretty close to the Meridian fault line. Could that go all the way up to North Dakota or Minnesota, follow the Mississippi River or something? I'm just curious.
Yeah, that's a good question. Lucy Jones, what's the answer?
Okay, so yes, we have voluntary earthquakes in Oklahoma.
Voluntary earthquakes.
Well, earthquakes that could be stopped by changing patterns. You've got to decide that you want to give up all of that economic benefit that comes from the fracking activities. It's not the fracking itself that's setting off earthquakes. It's the disposal of wastewater associated with that has been generated by the fracking. If you increase the fluid pressure at depth, you set off earthquakes nearby. And in Oklahoma, they've been setting off earthquakes so above magnitude, like up to magnitude 5.8 so far. There is a fault there that's probably long enough to give you a magnitude 7. It's the length of the fault that moves in an earthquake that determines the magnitude. Getting all the way from there up to Minnesota is not something I would worry about at all. There's no fault that runs through there, and it's an extremely large distance. I can't imagine that happening. North Dakota's also had small earthquakes. They used to never have any earthquakes at all. They've had small ones because of the fracking. They haven't had nearly the big ones that have been going on in Oklahoma.
So I don't know if that's any comfort to our caller, but there you go. Let's take another call. This is Mike calling from Lincoln, Nebraska. Mike, what's on your mind? Mike, are you there?
Oh,
hey.
Still there.
Okay, great. What are you are you thinking about today?
Go.
Yeah.
Hello, Alyssa.
Hi.
Well, I've been listening, and much of the activity focuses on earthquakes. But like the previous caller, I'm in part of that country where we're known as Tornado Alley. And we get, regular siren alerts in the springtime, occasionally in the summer, and sometimes in the fall, where tornadoes will come through.
Uh-huh.
Some are very small. We've had microbursts, but we've also had larger events. And last year or the year before, we did actually have an earthquake here, which people were talking about over coffee. It was like, did you feel the earthquake? No, and I actually felt tremors. Mm-hmm. While lying in bed, aftershock.
And do you have a question for Dr. Jones?
I've been dealing with this sort of thing, all my life.
Yeah.
And it's that, it's preparatory. We use the model, I personally use the model from the Cuban Missile Crisis, where we stored food, canned foods and such, in the basement. And people don't seem to be following those models anymore.
Thanks so much for your call, Mike, there in Nebraska. Lauren Augustine, any thoughts on what you were hearing there about preparation and what to expect in Tornado Alley?
Yeah, I'll say this kind of more generally. There's a lot of different risks, right? There's a lot of things that could happen. And this kind of gets to Lucy's point that scientists are very comfortable talking about uncertainty. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to decision making, it's really hard to make decisions around uncertainty. And so one of the things that we learned in our communities where we were working is that we kind of flipped that conversation around and we talked about consequence analysis. What's important here in Charleston or in Cedar Rapids? What cannot happen? What's the worst case scenario that cannot happen? And when you start to look at the consequence rather than all the ways, all the different things that could happen. It's an earthquake, it's a tornado, no, it's a flood. When you start to look at the consequences, schools must stay open. The roads must stay open. We can't lose the tourists. We have to get the grain out. We have to keep the oil and gas transit moving. Whatever the thing is, it's a lot easier to get this alignment around the different sectors of the community, around a community priority.
And thinking about that notion of uncertainty, Lucy Jones, in your book, you mentioned this obsession with folks who really want you to be able to predict earthquakes, and you got a letter from somebody, you write, who said, I know you can't tell me when the next earthquake will be, but will you tell me when your children go to visit out-of-town relatives?
Yes.
In other words, you must know something, right? You must know something that you're just not telling them.
Right, because it's so terrifying that we really don't. And Lauren's right. I mean, this thing of uncertainty, scientists love uncertainty. We're like the only people in the world that like uncertainty. Our job is studying it and analyzing it. But, you know, that's not how people make decisions. And I also, in my own research, I went from doing all foreshocks and probabilities and all the statistical stuff to doing an impact analysis, to creating scientific scenarios, because I realized that people weren't making decisions with probabilities. But when they can see what the consequences are, then it's a lot easier to make decisions. It's what we saw here in Los Angeles, really faced with, okay, I don't know when the earthquake's going to be, but when it happens, you aren't going to have water for months. That ended up leading to the city of Los Angeles really changing how it's running its water system and moving towards making a much more robust one.
Lauren Augustine, I wonder, when you think about Hurricane Katrina in 2005 and the catastrophic failure of the levees in New Orleans, so compounding a natural disaster with man-made disaster and flaws, what are the takeaways from that? What are the lessons, and do other municipalities ask you, you know, could this happen here? Obviously, New Orleans, it's its own case because of its geography, but what is the takeaway from that disaster?
You know, I think that in Hurricane Katrina, there's so many lessons. You know, there were so many things that happened in that event that people just didn't really think would happen in the United States. One is this piece about the cascading element. One is the piece about governance, that there was a lot of decisions made in different kinds of ways, that a lot of those decision-making processes have changed since Katrina. I will say that I think that one of the lasting legacies of Hurricane Katrina is that, you know, that this was a really lethal event, and we don't normally have lethal events at that scale. People die, like Lucy was saying earlier, 10s, 20s, 30s, maybe 80s, but 1,800 dead is something we don't see here.
Yeah.
So that was really devastating, and people took a really hard look at the fatality piece.
And so much of it preventable, yeah?
Yeah, and so much of it preventable. The other thing that people take a look at in Katrina is that it was also a political event. You know, this is a case where from the president of the United States all the way down to the mayor, everyone took a really big political hit, some bigger than others. But there was this understanding, as Lucy says in her book, about assigning blame.
Mm-hmm.
But there was this piece about, you know, where did it fall apart? Where were decisions not being made well? And since Katrina, you know, the ways that emergency management is layered, the way that FEMA will pre-stage now, they still have to wait for the governor to call the president. You know, no one's going to supersede that, but they will pre-stage if something looks like it's coming down the pike. So there was a lot of lessons out of Katrina that I hope we don't have to relive again in another part of the country.
Lucy Jones, just connecting with what Lauren Augustine was just talking about and the lessons for FEMA and pre-planning and positioning. I was just down, you know, last year in Houston after Hurricane Harvey, and people were doing it for themselves. I mean, they were not necessarily waiting for federal help or to come in because it was slow. It was still behind where they were, and they were organizing on their own and organizing really massive volunteer efforts to feed people, to house them.
It was rather interesting for me to look at the 2017 hurricane season, which was, of course, a very devastating one, just as I had finished the first manuscript of this book and was heading into copy editing. So it was a chance to sort of, okay, I thought all these things. How is it really playing out? And one thing that I found encouraging is how much better we're doing about response. Exactly what Lauren just said, of all the lessons that have been learned and incorporated, at the same time being really aware of what we are not doing about prevention. And that gets back to this, you know, prevention is just way more cost effective, and yet we have an emotionally much harder time with coping with it. And, you know, much of the damage in Houston, the professionals are going, yeah, told you so. That's what happens when you don't control impermeable surfaces.
Yeah.
No, I'd like to say one thing about the Houston, and actually since post-Sandy on the response.
Lauren Augustine, yeah.
Sorry about that. Is the expansion of the role of social media. So in 2005, when Katrina hit, you know, Facebook, and it wasn't as big as it was in 2012, where a lot of the, it's like you were saying, Melissa, a lot of the response was homegrown. It was bottom up. But there was a lot of activity that was done outside of the, quote, normal chain of command.
Absolutely,
and
yeah.
Response. And that's a very big difference that I think that the first responders and others will have to consider moving forward.
We need a boat over here. We've got people to rescue on this street. Let's go back to the calls to Spokane, Washington. And Dee, you're on point.
Hi, Melissa.
Hey.
I wanted to share with you how I prepare in Spokane with seven children.
Seven children, wow.
Seven children. So it's always been on my mind. I wouldn't say I'm a prepper, but more of a realist. I know that disasters can happen no matter what they are. We used to live in Tornado Alley in Tulsa, Oklahoma. We lived there for 10 years. We were in a Cat 1, which was scary enough, but we did have disasters all around us. So it showed me how unprepared I was when the power would go out for 2 weeks.
So what do you do to prepare now?
Well, now I know that the first thing that I need to think of is water. Obviously, the safety and other issues are just as important, but water is the most important in my mind. And I used to put back 5-gallon jugs, and they just took up too much space.
Mm-hmm.
So finally, I decided to go to the local agricultural store, and I bought a 500-gallon tank that fits really snugly in my garage. I even have a small garage, but it fits nicely, and we have a pump for it. And in addition to that, they sell water bags that go in your bathtub. So we have 3 bathtubs, and that adds an additional 300 gallons. So my family has 800 gallons of water. That a gallon a day gives us roughly 4 months to think about what our next move is.
Huh.
It gives us time. It pours us the ability to decide, do we stay where we are? Are we safe? Is there any social unrest? It would be 2 months if we decided 2 gallons a day for washing or anything. But that's primarily what I did, because none of the food I set back, which I did before, a lot of cans that went out of date, you know, so the dried food has to be activated.
Right.
And at the very least, if we have water and we're running out of food, we still have time.
So you've obviously given this a lot of thought. Dee, thanks for your call there in Spokane, Washington. Wrapping up with Lucy Jones. Lucy, I'm struck by one thing you mentioned when you talked about starting in this world in seismology, studying earthquakes. One of your colleagues said, time to start your wacko file. A lot of people who have a lot of crazy theories about earthquakes, none of them who called in today. We loved hearing from our listeners. Thank you so much. Lauren Alexander Augustine, Director of the Program on Risk, Resilience, and Extreme Events at the National Academy of Sciences. Lauren, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Dr. Lucy Jones, seismologist. She's author of the new book, The Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them. Dr. Jones, terrifying to talk to you, but also really helpful. Thanks so much.
Oh, this has been an enjoyable discussion. Thanks.
Great. Thanks for being with us. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Melissa Block. This is On Point.